It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Earlier this year, the conservative think tank The Heritage Foundation unveiled the blueprint for what they're calling Project 2025, a game plan to be used if a Republican is elected president in the next election. Here's Project 2025 director Paul Danz.
This is really a plan for conservatives to be ready to hit the ground running day one, January 20th, 2025. And what we're inviting is a whole new group of Americans and inspiring them to come to Washington and serve. This is really the pathway. We've lined up our what we believe in a policy book. We are recruiting people into a database. We're training people to tell them how the federal government functions and how they should function in government. And finally, we are drafting transition plans, all with the mind to advance the conservative agenda in 2025.
The report outlines how conservatives might boost executive power and, in their words, deconstruct the administrative state from the moment a Republican president is sworn in. That includes making it easier for a president to hire and especially to fire a broad category of federal workers. Some Republican presidential candidates have endorsed the idea of changing these federal employment protections, including the frontrunner, former President Trump, who changed relevant rules but lost the election before putting them into practice. Our next guest has been watching the proposed changes closely and joins us now for a look at the possible impact, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What policy, what administrative changes would you like to see if a Republican were elected as the next president of the United States? How about a Democrat? Do you think the president and the executive branch should have more or less power, especially when it comes to political appointees, other appointees in the federal government, and civil service jobs? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Don Kettle is Professor Emeritus and former Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was a longtime professor here in Wisconsin. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi there, Rob. It is great to be back with you and all my friends in Wisconsin.
Now, this document we're talking about from Heritage and other groups, over 900 pages. A lot of it is policy related. I want to focus in on this personnel issue, Don. We've talked about this some before. Now, federal employment policy may sound like an arcane issue. Why are these proposed changes important?
This is, I think, really fundamentally important to how it is that the Republicans are planning to approach the government in general if they win in 2024. This, first of all, is a really serious document that needs to be taken extremely seriously, whether you're a fan or not. I actually weighed it in on the scale, and it's 5 pounds. So you can buy a second one and you can build up your biceps just by doing bookshelf lifts in the morning. It is just incredible in detail. But in particular, there's a strong focus in going after what the Republicans are calling the deep state, to try to root out government officials who they believe were not sufficiently responsive to President Trump during his term, and making sure that loyalists can be put into place when, as they hope, Republicans win in 2024. The basic goal, the basic strategy, is to try to replace people who are not, as they say, accountable to the election and to the wishes of elected officials, and to make it easier to replace them with people who, in fact, are loyal. Big question, how many people could this involve? And at the early stages, there was talk that maybe it could be maybe a few thousand. But I conducted an interview with the person who wrote the Trump executive order, who said that he easily could imagine 50,000 federal officials being involved. And then as we talk further, said maybe it could be as much as 100,000. Toward the end, ultimately, I think where this is going in the long game is an effort to try to make all federal employees subject to removal by the president. So this is a fundamental piece, not only in terms of figuring out where the expertise of government ought to rest and the role of politics in government, but also in the balance of powers between the branches. So it's hard to imagine anything more fundamental than this.
Can you talk about what got us to where we are now? What are some of the protections for most non-political appointees, and why are they in place?
The basic principles here, and it really goes back not only in the federal government, but also there in Wisconsin during the administration of Robert La Follette as governor, was an effort by the progressives, not as progressives as we understand them now, but progressives in terms of the progressive movement around the dawn of the 20th century, to bring expertise in government and to wring out the role of machine politics. And so the idea was to try to be sure, allow elected officials at the top to make policy, but then to hire in experts who were supposed to be neutrally competent, as the saying went, and pursue the strategies and tactics that policy officials, elected officials, set for them. And so that the idea was that the policymakers would make policy, but that the bureaucracy would be in charge of administering it in a way that was politically impartial. But what's happened over time is a growing belief by conservatives that there were too many liberals and Democrats in the bureaucracy who saw it as their goal to frustrate the efforts of the policymakers. And so now they want the power to be able to remove them and to replace them with people who they believe will be more loyal and more representative of the kind of policies that the new elected officials would want to pursue.
And that's, I think, the core to the argument for making these changes, whether at the end of the Trump administration, in a rule that was reversed by the Biden administration, or with a new president in 2025. Hey, the people elected this person as president. Let's help that elected president overcome the inertia of this large body of officials by giving the president the power to remove more of them. Is there a problem with that?
Yeah, I think there's a huge problem with this. But first, let me acknowledge the fact that they absolutely positively do have a point, that as I've talked with senior federal officials over time, every single one of them can point to somebody that they had to work with, that they would like to have removed, would like to have fired, but have found it either impossible to do or simply concluded it would take much too much effort to be able to do, and so they just gave up. And then in addition, there is a new report that's really been out just for the last week and a half, and it is by one of the conservatives who was responsible for the Trump initiative, and he cites chapter and verse of elected officials who wanted to do things during the Trump administration and political appointees, but found themselves in a position where they were handcuffed, they thought, by either people who were slow walking their proposals inside the bureaucracy, dragged their heels and refused to do it, refused to give the right kind of policy advice, but one way or another just undermined those efforts. And so the effort was, okay, that's something that we have to change, they think. That the problem is that the more that we end up in a situation where the people begin to suspect that there's a political spin on every single decision that comes through the bureaucracy, to that degree, I think that the trust in government in general would be undermined, and that the competence of government to do what needs to be done could be seriously eroded. That, I think, is a very big problem.
We're talking to Don Kettle, Professor Emeritus and former Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, looking at sweeping changes to the executive branch being proposed by a coalition of conservative think tanks in the event of a Republican presidential election win. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You've heard the basics. What else do you want to know? What questions do you have? What do you think about this? Should the president of whatever party be able to fire and hire more categories of elected officials, or should we restrict that to some of the top-level political appointees? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Don Kettle from the University of Maryland, looking at Project 2025, a conservative think tank's contingency plan for if a Republican is elected president in 2024. Among other things, it would give the president a lot more power to hire and fire a wide variety of federal employees. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. James is with us in Milwaukee. James, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, James?
Well, my thinking is, and I look back at history because that is what I graduated with, a degree in history. Mm-hmm. And I look back and I think to myself, because I've seen time and again that presidents have wanted to get rid of folks they don't like. I think a president should only be restricted to getting rid of top federal employees, not all federal employees.
James, thanks a lot for the call. And Don, that is effectively how it works now. We've got some of those top-level cabinet officials and others that need Senate confirmation, some other top-level ones. Who right now can the president at will fire?
Yeah, that's a good question. And right now we have about 2.2 million federal employees. This covers everybody from air traffic controllers and TSA screeners to people in the Customs and Border Protection and the FBI. And the president has the power to appoint about 6,000 of them tops, depending on how it is that you look at the numbers and count them up. So that the vast, vast, vast majority of federal employees are those who are in the career service and can't be fired except for cause. And so that's the sense of the overall lineup of things. That the complaint that the conservatives make, however, is that too many of those 2.2 million federal employees are in key positions who have been in a position to frustrate what they've wanted to do. And so they've also concluded that these people are impossible to fire for cause, or at least so hard that no person, no manager would ever want to do it more than once because it's so aggravating. So they want the ability simply to be able to replace them. And so that's where the battle lines are being drawn here.
Thanks for the call, James. A concern, a criticism, Don, is that this could be a big boost to executive power. In the most dire critiques I've seen, that this is potentially an authoritarian move. Is that overstating the concern?
Well, I don't think it's authoritarian per se, at least not at this point. But it is a kind of radical shift in the balance of power. And it's something that I wrote about in a piece that was published today in govexec.com in Washington, where I think what really is going on here is that the conservatives really imagine a far stronger executive branch. They don't look at Congress as an institution that can be moved, and that, as we've seen even today, Congress is having a terrible time even trying to find a way to forget about passing a budget, even granting an extension of the decisions to be able to pass a budget. And in addition to that, they know that the Supreme Court and the other elements of the judicial system are now more reliably conservative, but they're not primarily involved in policymaking. So what this really is an effort to try to strengthen the executive branch, to strengthen the president, to strengthen the president's control of the bureaucracy. And this really represents, in my mind at least, that the most dramatic shift in power and the balance of powers in government toward the presidency since the time the Constitution was written. And so one of the reasons why I think we need to pay such careful attention to this is that the fundamental implications are enormous. And it's not clear to me that in general we've really thought this through. This is the kind of thing that come slipping through gradually, bit by bit by bit, as more decisions are made. And we could find ourselves in a very different position in just a few years, depending on how much of this might go through.
Is this something that a president can just do via executive order? Say, hey, I'm changing the rules to give me more power here, no checks, no balances?
There's a big debate over that right now. Ramaswamy, in fact, a week ago, claimed that he could reduce the size of the federal workforce over the course of perhaps a first term by perhaps as much as 75%. And he countered the critics by saying that he has authority under the president's authority to have reductions in force and also reorganization to be able to make that happen. I think that's not true. But again, it gets back to the basic question of the separation of powers. Can a president claim that he has the authority to have such a fundamental power to reshape the nature of the bureaucracy? If you think that this matters, or maybe if you think that it doesn't, consider back to the time when there was the famous Sharpie Gate case, where the President Trump had made a mistake in where it was that he had drawn the projections for the onslaught of a hurricane in the southeast, and went back and corrected it himself by drawing on the map a much broader cone of where it is that the storm may go. Well, that got a lot of laughs on late night TV, but there was tremendous pressure on the inside of the Hurricane Forecast Center for the forecasters who were involved to try to get them to change their forecast to match what it is that the president had said. And so the risks of having something that would go that deep into the basic process of even forecasting where a hurricane might go is something that could have dramatic impact, not only on the performance of government, but how much we trust anybody to say anything.
And Don, in the closing days of the Trump administration, we had the president pressuring various officials to take actions to claim fraud in the election that wasn't there. Ideas were floated of like a seizing voting machines and things like that. Is there a concern that, hey, if everybody is handpicked by the president and partisan helpers, that a president might be more able to find somebody to willing to follow orders, even if they might exceed the law?
I think that's exactly the case. And one of the first issues is that the nature of the law is always subject to interpretation. And if you can find somebody who interprets it as you like, then you have that much more power. It also is a matter of asking how many speed bumps there are to try to restrain the exercise of executive power. Throughout the course of history, the strongest ways of trying to undermine the democracy that countries have tried to establish and the powers that the people have come through the exercise of executive power. And so the question is, what kind of restraints might there be? How many speed bumps should there be? And the fewer speed bumps there are in the way, that the easier it would be for an executive to try to seize control. Of course, the Republicans and conservatives would argue that they're not certainly trying to do that. All they want to do is to be able to say, if we get elected, what we want is the ability to be able to put our policies into place. But of course, that raises precisely the kinds of risks that you've talked about, Rob.
Don, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
So great to be with you.
That's Don Kettle, professor emeritus and former dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution once upon a time here at UW-Madison as well. We talked to him about Project 2025, a conservative think tank's blueprint for the next Republican presidency, including big changes in how federal employees are hired and especially fired. Like many indigenous languages, Ho-Chunk is considered endangered as native speakers die out. Now, tribal leaders are turning to technology to try to preserve Ho-Chunk in the digital age. Sarah Lear reports.
On a recent summer day, about half a dozen teenagers gathered alongside their elders inside the Ho-Chunk Community Center in Black River Falls. They're meeting in western Wisconsin to record Ho-Chunk words and phrases for an e-learning portal. Adrian Thunder manages the tribe's language program.
So by the time we get done with this, we'll be able to enter all of these sound recordings today into the matrix, I guess, that we have set up for the app.
The app should be released later this year as part of a collaboration with a nonprofit called the Language Conservancy. There are nearly 8,000 members of the Ho-Chunk Nation, most of whom live in Wisconsin. But tribal leaders estimate there are fewer than 40 native Ho-Chunk speakers left in the entire country. One of them is 83-year-old Maxine Colner. For her, the loss of a language would spell the loss of something deeper.
We can't call ourselves a tribe because we lost our language and would probably be not considered Ho-Chunk anymore.
Language Conservancy CEO Will Maya says a majority of the nearly 7,000 languages spoken worldwide are on track to become extinct in the next century. Those most in danger are indigenous languages that were nearly wiped out after colonization.
In North America, as well as Australia, you know, we're really at the epicenter of a worldwide extinction event when it comes to languages.
During the 19th and 20th centuries, indigenous Americans were sent to boarding schools where the federal government forced them to assimilate to white culture. Ho-Chunk Public Relations Director Casey Brown says those effects are still being felt.
All the Ho-Chunks that are alive today have a family member that went through the being put in Indian schools where they weren't supposed to speak their language. They were supposed to forget their culture.
The tribe has been working over the last several decades to revive the Ho-Chunk language. Last year, it partnered with the Language Conservancy to launch an online dictionary with words recorded by elders. But for the forthcoming app, the nation is incorporating younger voices like Kane Hall's. Inside the community center, the 18-year-old records the phrase, "He is a first son." 85-year-old Myrtle Long is on hand to correct his pronunciation.
That doesn't sound right.
Ho-Chunk used to be an exclusively oral language. The tribe's education coordinator, Jesse Falcon, says that's why the knowledge of elders like Long is essential. They understand nuances that can't be conveyed in writing. Falcon sees the language as a link to culture. That's part of why she sent her daughter, Naomi Little George, to a Ho-Chunk immersion daycare. But once Naomi went to school, she started speaking less Ho-Chunk.
I had family members kind of saying, "Why aren't you making her speak Ho-Chunk? We need her speaking Ho-Chunk."
But Falcon felt it had to be her daughter's choice.
The state of the language, this is, you know, very important. I was like, but that's a lot to put on those little bitty shoulders.
Now Naomi's 16. She giggles when she shares her favorite Ho-Chunk phrase.
It's like to say that someone's bow-legged. It's hura geish wa-unje. It's like he or she is bow-legged.
That affection for Ho-Chunk was apparent when Naomi chose to spend part of her summer doing recordings for the new app. The goal, bring Ho-Chunk to another generation of speakers. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read that story and see a lot more from the WPR News Department at WPR.org and stream live or check out the archives of your favorite Ideas Network shows along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. United Auto Workers are on their fifth day on strike against the big three U.S. automakers Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, which includes Chrysler and other brands. So far, it's been a partial strike limited to manufacturing plants in Missouri, Michigan, and Ohio, representing roughly 13,000 of the 146,000 workers in the full union. Union President Sean Fain said this week that if the two sides don't make significant progress by Friday, the strike will expand to include more workers at more plants around the country. The UAW is seeking wage increases and expanded benefits that automakers say are beyond what's sustainable for their businesses. It's a historic strike against the three automakers. We're learning more now about the labor market and the economic forces involved, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see come out of this strike? Do you know someone in the UAW? Are you involved in this or in the auto industry? Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Michael Childers is professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. He's an expert on labor unions, collective bargaining, production standards, and labor management relations in union environments. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Always a pleasure, Rob.
Michael, set the stage for us a little here. How do we get to this point where the UAW is doing this sort of rolling strike?
It's been unique in this respect. Their tactics have completely deviated from previous playbooks. And I think it really does have the auto manufacturers on edge in that, they've basically broken all of the traditional rules in terms of how they've negotiated contracts in the past.
What specifically is the UAW seeking for workers?
Again, I think your intro covered it fairly well, and it's similar to a lot of the other labor negotiations that have occurred this summer. I'm thinking of specifically the UPS and Teamsters negotiation. But basically what workers are looking for are substantial increases to their wages. They'd like to get back to where they had been basically, in terms of purchasing power. It's not even necessarily that they're the raises that they're looking for, I guess I'll put it in a different context, would get them back to parity with the wages that folks were earning prior to some concessionary contracts that have been negotiated. Another major bargaining point is the use of the disparate pay for the same work, what sometimes are called tiers. And that, again, was a major issue in the IBT-UPS negotiation. And maybe you've seen pictures of the UAW president, but that's what he's talking about when you see his T-shirt that says end tiers. So
let's give a listen to UAW President Sean Fain talking about the impact of a widespread auto worker strike on automakers and the economy.
In the last 4 years, the price of cars went up 30%. CEO pay went up 40%. No one said a word. No one had any complaints about that. But now, God forbid that workers actually ask for their fair share of equity in the fruits of the labor and the product they produce. And all of a sudden, it's the end of the world. So, you know, you know, the talking heads, the pundits, the companies want to say that, you know, if we strike, it can wreck the economy. It's not that we're going to wreck the economy. We're going to wreck their economy, the economy that only works for the billionaire class. It doesn't work for the working class.
I want to get into that last point, Michael. Sean Fain, UAW president there, he has widened this in some ways beyond this is about automakers and the UAW to wider critiques of the U.S. economy. What do you think of that part of their unusual playbook?
I think it's just to bring more awareness that, again, and we've lost most of our auto manufacturing here in our state, mm-hmm. but it's the idea being that, you know, what workers are asking for, and I think the point he's trying to make is it's not unreasonable and it's actually very much in line with what is happening generally in the economy. It's that, hey, if the price of a gallon of milk and a gallon of gas goes up, we should be able to cover those expenses with our wages. We're here, we're generating the value, the profit that this company enjoys, and we'd like to share equitably in those profits.
Automakers have argued they couldn't sustain compensation at those rates. Here's Ford CEO Jim Farley also talking to CNN here about his worries.
Sean's requests are very clear. He proposed a nearly $300,000 fully fringed wage for each of our factory workers to work 4 days a week. And if we had done that in our business, when we've had a couple of really great years here, we would have gone bankrupt many years ago. $15 billion of losses, we'd have to close plants, most people would lose their jobs, we'd have no money to invest.
And this is what companies often say when faced with a strike and demands for higher wages, but is there something to that? Are the big three automakers sustainable with this higher level of compensation that UAW workers are asking for?
They absolutely are. And I think, again, part of collective bargaining in the United States that it seems opaque to people who've never had to participate in it is that both sides have to go in with offers that are far from where they would be willing to settle, but that's the nature of the way it's conducted here in the United States. So, for example, the Ford person was actually citing as if they were going to agree to the opening proposal that the UAW made, which, of course, UAW is not necessarily expected. I mean, they would be happy to accept that, but they're not expecting that that's where things would settle. And I think corporate profits speak for themselves, right? Thanks to the Securities and Exchange Commission, we actually have access to corporate finances, and the finances bear out. This was the case with the Teamsters and the UPS strike as well, or the UPS potential strike as well, that the profits are there. What the workers are asking for are not unreasonable. Absolutely, does it reduce profits? Sure. Are the companies not going to make as much money as they would have liked? Of course. But again, it's not that it's unaffordable. It's that how much would you like to afford? So
we're talking to Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, looking at the UAW strike, a partial strike so far. We'll see what happens on Friday if a deal isn't met. Love to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Your questions about what's at stake, how these kind of negotiations might work, and if you are personally affected, definitely love to hear from you. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Michael, you've watched over the years a lot of strikes and a narrowly averted strikes like the UPS one you mentioned. What are you watching for to see how the two sides negotiate and if they're going to arrive at a middle ground that they agree on?
Well, like you said, I started with that this was sort of unprecedented in terms of the way that the UAW has bargained with the big three always in the past. I think you've already pointed out, the other shoe is in the air with respect to, the union has already telegraphed that they would like to move towards concluding an agreement by noon Friday. Otherwise, there will be an escalation. They've basically said that. What I've also been watching is, in the past, the Canadian auto workers also bargained as a part of the United Auto Workers. Now it's a separate union called Unifor. And they've conducted their negotiations sort of in the old school tradition, in that they're only bargaining with Ford right now and had actually threatened a strike against Ford at midnight yesterday, or this morning rather. And at the 11, literally between 11 and midnight yesterday, got a substantial offer, is the way it's been reported in the media so far, and so far have suspended that strike for another 24 hours. So this time tomorrow, the Ford workers in Canada may also be on the picket line.
One critique of strike efforts like this is that, okay, maybe UAW workers win, but that ups the incentive for automakers to open plants in other countries or maybe in states with more lax labor laws. Could unions be shooting themselves in the foot here?
I think in a real sense, that cow has left the barn, in the sense that if you look at where all domestic manufacturing has been located site-wise for the last literally 40 years, it has been the case, right, that it's been primarily in the Southeast or in the global South, whether it's Mexico or the offshoring of jobs even further. So in a real sense, I don't know that that's necessarily a threat. And I think that's another point that we had not really brought up, which is another one of the major demands is the UAW is looking for assurances that, with the new technology coming online and the new vehicles being primarily electric, that foregoes the need for an engine and a transmission in these vehicles, which means those are plants that employ many workers. And the UAW would like to see those workers be allowed to transition to things like battery factories, which are going to be coming online, obviously, to support the new EV.
So we're going to call her at 800-642-1234. Raleigh is with us in Oak Creek. Raleigh, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about the states that have right-to-work laws. How does that affect the workers, the company, the negotiations? How does that all work out? Can these workers go to work during a strike?
Raleigh, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, many states, including Wisconsin, now have these what are called right-to-work laws, limiting the power of unions in a lot of ways. Does that affect this ongoing strike and these negotiations?
No, thanks for the call. It's a really good question because I think it's confusing to a lot of people. Mm. What right to work does is actually, it was implemented as a part of the Taft-Hartley Act post-World War II after the large strike wave here in the United States. And a lot of people called it the clipping of labor's wings in a sense, because what it did was workers who are in a unionized environment are still represented by their union. As a matter of fact, their union has a duty, a legal duty, to represent them fully. They're still subject to the terms of the contract. I think your question is more, can people cross picket lines? Yes, obviously there's a word for that. In the labor lingo, they would call those folks scabs. And in a sense, what they're saying is, those are our jobs and you're actually going in and doing my work while I'm in a dispute with my employer. Right to work doesn't really play into that directly, for example. I guess the thing about right to work is the way it weakens unions is, even though unions are obligated by law to represent, negotiate contracts, defend these workers, the workers have the option to not pay their union dues. So hopefully that clarifies that for you, Raleigh. But yes, Workers can obviously can cross a picket line. Most don't, because the most important word in the vocabulary of especially unionized workers is solidarity.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to UW-Madison Labor Education Professor Michael Childers about the UAW strike going on now against the big three automakers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a member of a union or maybe even the UAW? What do you think of this strike and how they're handling it? And in general, do you have questions? Do you have thoughts on how you want to see this all come out? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Michael Childers, labor education professor at UW-Madison. He's with us today looking at labor negotiations between the UAW and the big three automakers that led to the current strike. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the auto workers' strike? What questions do you have about the negotiations between the UAW and automakers? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Andrew is with us in Milwaukee. Andrew, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Andrew?
So I wanted to bring up, when I was in Argentina, I studied abroad there from UW-Madison, and there was a big strike going on. The public teachers were renegotiating their contracts, and the bus drivers, the subway drivers, it seemed like there was a lot of strikes in solidarity and mass mobilization of workers. And I remember hearing that that was illegal or something like that in the United States, kind of those cross-the-board strikes.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, I seem to remember historically there being solidarity strikes from unions not directly involved in a negotiation. Is that something that does happen? As Andrew asks, is that something that can happen?
I think it, in the sense that if it can happen or not, workers can do what they want to do. Sometimes even regardless of what their union leaders are telling them they should do. But I think it's a great question in the sense that the reason, yes, that's absolutely a part of labor history here in the United States. General strikes is what they were mostly called. And you saw these happen like citywide, like San Francisco will go on strike. Minneapolis will go on strike. When they passed our U.S. labor law, which was back during the Depression in the 1930s, part of what this it was the Wagner Act at that point. It's now called the National Labor Relations Act. And what it tries to do is to get the parties to work out their differences without having to resort to work stoppages, to strikes. And the reason why in the United States, well, two reasons why you don't see more of these widespread strikes or sympathy strikes is, number one, most unions and their employers, when they negotiate out a mutual agreeable contract, will put in no strike, no lockout clauses, which basically means that for the duration of this agreement, we agree that we will not go on strike. So that's one sort of detriment to, as far as like that there would be a sympathy strike or other workers joining workers that are on strike against their employer. The other thing would be partly the changes in the law we mentioned, what the Taft-Hartley Act did with respect to the creation of the so-called right to work, where union members could actually opt out of paying their dues. Another change was it made secondary strikes, in other words, the strike against not the direct employer, against the law, and actually the unions could be liable for damages for going out on strike against someone that is not the primary target. So both of those contribute to the reasons why you don't see that very often here in the United States.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. William joins us now in Lake Geneva. William, hi.
Hi. My daughter is an engineering manager for General Motors, and her husband happens to also work for General Motors in the UAW. And it's interesting because last year, they each made over $100,000. The difference being that my daughter, with a master's in engineering and material science, divided up, she works on average 65 to 70 hours a week, and divided up her salary, and she makes less than her husband with just a high school degree did in the UAW hourly. And it kills me because I hear on the news that the average UAW worker makes close to $50 an hour, has 5 weeks paid vacation, has 17 paid national holidays. I'm 60 years old. I don't have those benefits, not even close.
William, thanks for the call. Michael Williams saying UAW workers already have it pretty good.
They absolutely do. And that's the fruits of many, many negotiations with their employer and the sacrifices that generations of auto workers made prior to even these current negotiations. I guess the difference between the two scenarios that were discussed is, I'm assuming that the gentleman's daughter does not have a union. And in the United States, if you want to be able to sit down as an equal with your employer and bargain around hours, wages, and your conditions of work, the way you get those rights are by joining with your coworkers and forming a union. And interestingly, there are professional unions. For example, I think he said she's an engineer. Mm-hmm. The Boeing engineers that work for Boeing Corporation that build the airplanes have formed and do negotiate with Boeing as a collective bargaining agent. They're unionized.
William, thanks a lot for calling in. Michael, what are you watching for next now in this UAW partial strike to see if we're going to get some progress here?
Well, like everyone, I've been following it with a lot of interest and pretty closely. Before they actually took the three individual plants, one from each of the automakers out, I was curious exactly what direction they were going to go and how. So I'll be very interested to see what happens if there isn't significant progress by Friday in terms of how they choose to escalate, if it'll be more assembly plants, because another option that they could have taken that I think some people had expected was they could, and this comes from actually the history of the auto workers, if you take out a key component in the supply chain, for example, brakes, right? You can't ship any products if you don't have the parts available to have brakes on the vehicle. So by just striking the one plant, the ripple effect over some amount of time would impact all of the assembly plants, for example. So, I mean, I'm watching that in terms of how they choose to escalate on Friday if they need to. And I'm also watching what's going to happen in Canada, because again, while they don't have near the footprint that the UAW does in North America, if they do strike Ford, that's going to have a pretty dramatic and pretty quick impact on Ford's operations.
And Michael, moving beyond the auto industry now, in addition to the UAW, you've mentioned the UPS narrowly averted strike. We had the rail workers. We've got the ongoing strikes for actors and writers in the TV and movie industries. It seems like there's a lot going on in the union world these days. Are we at some kind of turning point in American labor history?
I mean, you got to let the historians write that, right? I think it's interesting because, the Gallup poll, as far as public opinion around unions, has never been this high in my lifetime. And I mean, I think the part we just left out were the things like the Starbucks baristas. And there has been sort of this, I mean, I think coming out of COVID, maybe a renaissance in terms of workers expecting more from their work life. And again, as I just mentioned earlier, the way in the United States you get the right to have a voice at work as an equal with your employer is by joining with your coworkers and forming a union.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure. Take care, Rob.
That's Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. He was with us today to talk about the historic UAW strike against Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, now on its fifth day, possibly expanding on Friday if a deal isn't reached. Well, we don't have those plants closing here in Wisconsin, but do you have a connection with somebody who is in the middle of this story, who is on strike or looking at it happening over the next week or so? Love to hear from you at ideas@wpr.org. Again, you can email ideas@wpr.org if you've got a personal connection to this story. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, take a look at Wisconsin's controversial voting maps as redistricting lawsuits head toward the state's Supreme Court, and a proposed law in the state legislature aims to overhaul the whole process. find out all the different pieces about what's going on and what's at stake, and you could join in with your thoughts. What do you want to see happen? Get started now. Email ideas at WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. A couple weeks back, we talked to a physical therapist about adapting our exercise and fitness as we age. We heard from a lot of you from your 60s on up who are still doing amazing amounts of great exercise, much more than I do. One mentioned kayaking, a lot of kayaking. Well, I got inspired by that. I was out for a long weekend for a couple days there, went on a little trip, and my wife and I did go out kayaking on a lake a few times. It was great, but my wife went out one extra time while I stayed in, and she got a bonus. A bird watching bonus where she saw two bald eagles, one golden eagle, red-tailed hawk, and a few sandhill cranes. I didn't miss out completely. I saw a heron, a couple cormorants on one of my outings. But staying on shore that one time, I did not get the big bird bonanza. It's another surprising benefit of exercise. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.